At a time when investors are confronted with market volatility and a variety of challenges fueled by the uncertainty of inflation, unsettled geopolitical tensions, and economic pressures, Justin Klein and Steve Peasley stand ready to take your finance and investment questions and share their unbiased answers. This is InvestTalk, independent thinking, shared success. InvestTalk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. The clarity for your path forward starts now. Here is KPP Chief Executive Officer, Financial Advisor, Justin Klein.
Good afternoon, fellow investors, and welcome back to InvestTalk. This is our Monday, November 13th, 2023 edition. I am Justin Klein, and it is Monday, and that means Luke Guerrero is back with us to give his insights as we go along this hour. Thanks for being back, Luke.
Thanks for having me on this beautiful Monday.
Yeah, it's a beautiful fall Monday, getting into the swing of things when it comes to the holidays. What are we, just about 10 days away from Thanksgiving? So it's moving fast, and this year has moved by fast, and this hour will go by fast as well. And so we're going to try to move you along in an orderly fashion and give you the insights and the data that will help you become a better investor. And it's all about having useful data and having the right perspective. We'll give you our perspective, developed with over 20 plus years of investment experience. We're going to run down the market performance for the day, as well as some show topics, but right after we answer our first caller question.
Hey guys, I appreciate the show. I've become a daily listener. I've got a stock high up on my watch list. It's got a forward PE of around 12, and it might even be undervalued right now. The earnings forecast, return on equity, and a number of other metrics, they all look good. I'm wondering what you think of this stock and where support might be and what might be a good entry point. And that stock is Skechers, ticker SKX. Thank you much.
All right, looking at Skechers, this is a name that's been around a long time. I remember back in high school, actually in the 90s, when this was a kind of an up and coming brand. This was, It was a coach of ours whose daughter worked for Skechers or something. We got free Skechers. It was great. We loved it. But so Skechers has been around a long time, but it's still kind of a mid-cap name, about $7.5 billion market cap. No dividend yield here, but that doesn't mean it's a bad investment. No debt, Luke, which you know we like. Are you seeing anything that pops out for you on Skechers?
Well, taking a look at Skechers, I'm seeing that relative to its competitors, its margins aren't great. Its net margin is 6%, slightly below average. I personally love Skechers as a customer. I remember I loved their light-up shoes when I was a child.
Well, that's, I think they still have the light-up shoes.
Not for adults. And they're,
not for adults? Okay. Yeah, well, not, no adult sizes?
I haven't checked in a while, but I don't imagine they have it for adults.
Well, their business is doing pretty well. What's interesting here is that revenue growth has been slowing. About a year ago or so, it had about 20% year-over-year revenue growth on average in 2022. But this last quarter and the quarter before, it's only at 8%. So that revenue growth has slowed. But earnings growth has actually picked up. So earnings last quarter were up 53% year-over-year. So while those margins are maybe relatively low compared to their competitors, it has been improving as of late. So that's certainly a positive. Like I said before, one thing I really like is they don't have any debt. Enterprise value to EBITDA is right around 8x, which the five-year average is about 10. Five-year median is about 9. So it's definitely in the low end of its longer-term trading range in that multiple. Price to sales are right about 1x, so nothing too crazy. And once again, near the low end of its historical multiple trends. So from a valuation perspective, I have no issue with this. But once again, the growth is slowing on the top end. And you can only keep margins expanding so much, right? So three quarters in a row, you've had declining sales growth, but increasing earnings growth. So, but analyst upgrade trends are positive. Is that what you're seeing, Luke?
That's what I'm seeing as well. I also see that they do have some debt in the form of term loans, but like you said, it's minimal.
Yeah, it's pretty minimal. Yeah, I mean, they have some debt, but yeah, balanced out by the cash they have in their balance sheet. So the technicals are okay. That's obviously pulled back with the whole market since the top in August. And let me look at a ratio here. I always like to look at the ratio between Skechers or the underlying stock and its closest indices. So like the Russell, for example, would be this one. And it is outperforming. So I'm okay with this. I'm big on companies that have minimal debt, that have good positive cash flow. The valuation's in line with this. The technicals are fine, not amazing, but fine. So I'm going to give Skechers a thumbs up in my book because I just love that cash flow and the low debt and a good profitability metric. All right. So that was Skechers, but we have a lot of ground to cover over the next 40 minutes. And time permitting, we're going to touch on a few things. One is in regards to what is an inverse ETF? And inverse ETFs can act like insurance for an investor's portfolio. And so for this topic, I'm going to define what an inverse ETF is and talk about inverse ETF investing as well as how this can protect you from market volatility. On top of that, we're going to touch on the Moody's downgrade of the U.S. debt rating, or at least putting us on negative watch and what that might mean for markets and future spending by government. Also, AI is starting to analyze more than just random data on the internet. It's starting to analyze earnings call transcripts. And what might this mean for the future of analysis of these earnings calls? And then lastly, inflation. Inflation has been coming down across the world, but some countries are doing better at this than others. Some it's come down dramatically. Others it's remained sticky high. So we're going to look at that. We also have some voice bank questions. One is on municipal bonds. The other is on Toast, T-O-S-T. And we'll try to fit in an iTunes review question as well as my market perspective, which touches on the history of minimum wage here in the United States. Now let's talk about the market performance today. A kind of mixed bag overall, Luke. And I think everyone's kind of waiting for that CPI data that's supposed to come out tomorrow, right?
Yeah, that's correct. You know, the S&P 500 was pretty much flat, down slightly. It traded in a range between down around 40 basis points, up around 40 basis points, but finished the day pretty flat. But like you said, there wasn't much going on other than, you know, the New York Fed survey of consumer expectations showing that inflation expectations dropped in October to 3.6% from September. But I think a lot of people are just waiting to see what the CPI data shows to see if we're making more progress or if we've retraced some of the gains we had on CPI.
Yeah, and what might that mean for the interest rate path for the Fed as well as demand for the bonds, which we know there's a lot of supply coming on board consistently. So big data point coming out tomorrow, especially after last week was pretty much a dearth of economic data. So not much there. And we're coming into the end of earnings season as well. But right now, we're going to go to a quick break. Please remember that you can call anytime and leave your questions on the InvestTalk Voice Bank. If you're listening via our live stream or on AM 1220 radio in the Silicon Valley area, you can call right now at 888-99-CHART.
Justin Klein talks about the KPP Financial Premium Newsletter.
I want to remind you that this is a time where you probably need some guidance and you're tuning in to try to get our view of the markets. And we only have an hour here. And sometimes the way I distill each day can be maybe not enough time. And so our premium newsletter is a great tool for especially newer investors trying to learn some things.
The KPP Financial Premium Newsletter comes to your mailbox every Saturday.
Learn how to analyze the market, learn what the economic numbers mean, learn how to manage a portfolio, maybe get an idea of what are good companies to be at least looking at. Maybe you don't buy it today, but you should always have a watch list of companies that
hey, these are interesting. These have good businesses. And if they get to the right price, maybe I should buy them. So our newsletter is a great tool for that.
Subscribe anytime at investtalk.com. Justin Klein is here and ready to take your calls live. InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Hi, Steve and Justin. This is Kevin calling from Southern California. I've been looking at municipal bonds, trying to figure out if getting some exposure to that is good to diversify my fixed income portion of my investment portfolio. I am in the highest tax bracket again, and I'm wondering, is it better to buy a higher coupon rate with a higher price bond or a lower priced bond with yield to worst being equal? Trying to get an idea of what are the best options. Thanks again, as always.
All right. Glad you made that point about being in the highest tax bracket. That certainly is pretty much the most important factor when you're looking at municipal bonds. What tax rate are you in? It only pretty much makes sense for those that are in the highest tax bracket. Now, should you buy, basically he's asking, should I buy municipal bonds that are yielding little and are at a steep discount, or that have higher coupons and less of a discount? Most of them are discounts now, right? Because of where interest rates have moved. But a lot of this is more of a, once again, a tax question, because when you get those coupon payments, you're going to, you're not getting taxed. Now there's, I always think of this on corporate side, but you're not getting taxed either way. I guess it would be your income needs. That'd be the biggest question, is what income are you trying to get off of this, of these bonds? If it's a necessity for you, then you want the higher coupon. But if you're just trying to get a portfolio diversifier and you're trying to get a good after-tax yield, then I don't think it would matter. Anything to add, Luke?
Yeah, I think it pretty much comes down to how would you like to see the gains from holding those bonds. If you need income, like you said, then you're probably more wanting to have municipal bonds with higher coupon payments because it's going to be more regular income rather than just getting it from that capital gains aspect of holding a bond. But I think that, like you said, it comes down to making sure that you're in a tax bracket that makes this beneficial and then figuring out what the purpose of holding these bonds is for you.
Exactly. All right. Thanks for the call. Now, people take the time to leave an InvestTalk podcast review on iTunes. We'd like to thank them for the courtesy by getting to their questions quickly. PW Town 84 says, I'd love to get your thoughts on SWKS. It's been falling lately. I'm considering buying a position. Would you share some thoughts on the company and the current price for me? Now, this is Skyworks. We actually own this for some managed accounts. We've owned it pretty much since middle part of last year. It did great going into the end of last year, beginning of this year, and it's obviously pulled back on slower smartphone demand growth. But it is a very profitable business, and basically they make wireless chips for handsets. And these are very important chips because that's mainly how these products communicate, is wirelessly. And so while their business has pulled back, it is pretty cheap. For us, it's trading about a 30% discount to its true value. It's going to benefit from the growth of 5G. And so we like that. Now, the biggest worry, I think longer term, is if Apple tries to, mainly Apple, right? Because they're the most important player in the smartphone space. If they come out and produce their own RF components. Now, they've tried to do that internally, and they pretty much failed. They haven't done a good job of making that happen. So that's why they continue to use Skyworks products, and they're still the best in the business. So it is around support. It's been strengthening recently, and obviously we like it, so I give it a thumbs up. Thanks for the call. All right, this Invest Talk, now with more than 56.7 million downloads. Thanks all to you. Give us a call now. We're ready for your questions at 888-99-CHART.
Invest Talk is all about above average investing for the average investor.
And the question is, during a market downturn, do dividends stay fairly steady?
I wanted to see if you thought that that was a safer place to park the money for long term.
My question has to do with insuring residential rental properties.
Just kind of wondering if this stock is a value trap.
What's your question? You're the best person to ask it. 888-99-CHART.
And Justin Klein are ready to answer your finance and investment questions. Call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Let's go talk to George. He is in Washington State, and he's looking at Insolit Corp. P-O-D-D is the symbol. Do you own it or looking to buy it?
Considering to take a small position, trying to retrieve almost 50%, and it seemed to be stabilizing. There are some analyst ratings that predict that could possibly go back a little bit.
Well, this is a company that has pretty good growth, pretty strong growth, but that growth is slowing. Last quarter, revenues were up 27%, with quarter before that, it was at 32%. Earnings are accelerating, though. That's the positive. But the technicals have turned over from being around $330 per share earlier this year. Now we're at $163. And I would imagine this is probably some worries about the Ozempic craze. But, you know, will that really dampen the effect or the growth of diabetes? I'm still not sold either way, to be honest with you. I do know, I have a friend actually works for a company called Twin Health that basically guarantees the curing of diabetes in just a handful of months through monitoring and AI, et cetera. So, and they use Ozempic for those cases, in many cases. So I do worry a bit that this downtrend is telling us something. And Luke, I know you are seeing a lot of debt on their balance sheet as well.
Yeah, that's correct. I'm seeing that their net debt to EBITDA is 10 times higher than its industry competitors. It looks like their EBIT to interest expense is only 3. So they're operating on pretty thin margins in terms of their revenue relative to their debt.
Yeah, and their free cash flow is negative. Cash from operations is only $150 million on a market cap of $11 billion. Price sales is 7.5, very expensive. Enterprise value is 50, also very expensive, although obviously that's come down. But I just can't buy this. I don't like those headwinds from Ozempic and the potential for there being, and I know there is, I know there are increasing tools that are becoming more and more effective for diabetes. So, and it's a competitive space. You know, Abbott has a business, and there's a lot of public companies now that are big into the insulin administering and monitoring. And this is just way, 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 way too expensive for a company that has very thin margins. So while technicals have slightly improved over the past month, it's still in a long, strong downtrend and remains way too expensive. So I'm passing on Insulet Corporation. All right, now our focus point looks in the story behind this question. What is an inverse ETF and how can it protect you from market volatility? Now, Luke, I know you used to help run an ETF. Did you come across a lot of these inverse ETFs, and what are your thoughts on them in general?
Well, generally speaking, I think investors should realize that not all ETFs are created the same, right? Remember that ETFs are just a structure. So anytime you have a structure of a fund and there's a market for people who want to invest in a particular strategy, they're going to arise. And it doesn't necessarily mean that those ETFs are right for everybody. Now, inverse ETFs is not something that I would have had an opportunity to manage, nor something that I really came across, because they aren't really meant for long-term long holders.
Definitely not. But there is an increasing demand for them. Morningstar Direct says that worldwide and here in the U.S., U.S. inverse ETFs are inverse ETFs have an AUM as of June of $103 billion. And last year was record inflows, representing 3.7% of all ETFs purchased last year. It's pretty high. And for everyone out there, ETFs, inverse ETFs, typically will track a broad market indices. So they'll either be short the NASDAQ or the Russell or the S&P. And they'll use swaps to do that. And two of the biggest reasons investors buy inverse ETFs, one is to hedge a position. Other is to just simply bet on the downside of a particular sector, industry, or the market as a whole. Now, the two biggest issuers of inverse ETFs, ProShares and Direction Funds, even they admit that these aren't buy and hold investments. They're trading vehicles only, especially the leveraged ETFs that are out there. A lot of leverage, 2x, 3x, short the NASDAQ or the S&P. And for those that are, they don't want to take the time, they want a simple way to play a short-term direction of the market. I think they can be valuable. But as a buy and hold, doesn't really make sense. Now, could you be short against the box? Maybe you have an S&P 500 index fund and you buy the SH, which is a simply the single levered short S&P fund by iShares. But the expense ratio is high. So it's 0.89% versus for the plain vanilla S&P long SPY ETF, that's 0.03%, so 3 basis points. So big, big difference. So for everyone out there looking at inverse ETFs, if you ever use them for very short periods of time. All right. On the next Invest Talk, we'll look into stories set up by this headline: proof that staying invested beats timing the market. That story tomorrow. But for now, I'm Justin Klein. I'm ready to take your calls at 888-99-CHART.
This message is sponsored by Greenlight, the debit card and money app made for families. If you are a parent, have you noticed that as you are online, you may often see ads for various parenting hacks? In other words, quick solutions to tricky problems. Some hacks may be good ideas. Others, maybe not. Well, if you are committed to raising children that are made smarter and stronger by learning about financial responsibility, I encourage you to check out Greenlight. You see, as a debit card and money app made for families, Greenlight gives kids and teens an easy and fun way to gain financial literacy while providing peace of mind for parents. With Greenlight, you can send instant money transfers, automate your kids' allowance, and keep an eye on their spending with real-time notifications. Meanwhile, your kids can begin their journey towards financial autonomy by learning how to save, invest, and spend wisely. The Greenlight app includes a chores feature, so you can set up recurring or one-time tasks that are customized to your family's needs, and then reward your young ones for a job well done. Since 2017, Greenlight has helped more than 6 million parents and kids manage their finances. In fact, with Greenlight tools, families can even learn to invest together. Sign up today for Greenlight, the debit card and money app made for families, and get your first month free when you go to greenlight.com/investtalk. That's greenlight.com/investtalk to try Greenlight for free. greenlight.com/investtalk.
You've got a portfolio to grow and protect, and this is no time to lose focus. So get your finance and investment questions together and call Steve Peasley and Justin Klein.
They're ready with their unbiased answers. InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Let's go to Gene in North Carolina. How are you doing, Gene?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had a question for you and Luke. It's about what you just spoke about, the inverse ETFs and maybe even the leveraged ETFs, especially from ProShares. I always seem to get that special K-1 tax form that's associated with them at the end of the year. Can you comment about that aspect and whether that can be something that's predicted before you buy it?
I was unaware of that. It makes them even less attractive. K-1s are never fun to deal with. Why would they have K-1s? Can you think of a reason why?
I think it might be because the funds are generally treated as partnerships for tax purposes. So they're.
I think that's right.
Yeah, investors are allocated a share of the fund's income. So because of that, they're going to get a K-1 at the end of the year.
Now, do you know if that's all of the pro shares or just certain...
Many of them, but yeah, I think that's many correct. Now that I think about it, they are LPs. Yes.
Yeah, it might be because of the structure of how they invest. Because most ETFs are going to be long or short things, but they tend to use a lot of options and a lot of swaps. Mm-hmm. So because of that, they might not be able to register under the same ETF rules that allow for non-partnerships.
Ah, gotcha. That might make sense. Yeah, interesting. Well, that's a good point, Gene. I did not know that, since we don't really use them. But certainly that's a factor. K-1s are, like I said, never fun, especially if they're within a particular tax-deferred account, like an IRA or a 401k. Now, I guess the positive would be they pay income, though, right? Typically, would they owe income if they're shorting? Well, I guess they're using swaps. Why would they get a K-1 if there's no income, Luke? I guess it's.
I think it's generally the structure of their investments, and they're also subject to the 60-40 options rule, typically, where 60% is taxed at long-term, 40% short-term, regardless of the holding period.
Got it.
So a lot of complexity.
Overall, a lot of complexity, and another reason to mostly stay away from them, unless you have a really specific purpose, and you're willing to file a K-1. All right. Now let's touch on our perspective today that looks at the history of minimum wage in the United States. Now, minimum wage legislation emerged in the late 1800s to try to battle the sweatshops and in the wake of the Industrial Revolution. And so these sweatshops employed a lot of people, paying them what were considered non-living wages. And that was on top of having long work hours, bad, unsanitary, and unsafe work conditions. And from 1890s to the 1920s, during what was called the Progressive Era, states passed minimum wage laws. But it wasn't until 1933 when FDR, in the wake of the Great Depression, or during the Great Depression, passed into law the minimum wage. But I didn't know this, Luke. It was later found to be unconstitutional. So it took them until 1938 when the Fair Labor Standards Act established the federal minimum wage at 25 cents an hour, equivalent to $5.20 today. Still doesn't sound like a lot, does it?
No, it does not.
No. And its purchasing power peaked in 1968 at $1.60. And you found a really interesting chart, Luke, about the real and nominal value of federal minimum wage in the United States. And it's been flat since 2009. And before that, it pretty much marched up almost every year. So a lot of people said it's overdue to increase. But you know, it's just continued to decline. Now it's still at, was it $7.25 an hour? That's pretty wild. So I think this will change. Obviously, we're kind of in the start, I believe, of a new progressive era with labor rights, what's happening with unions, I think in a big way, changing the way people look at corporations and little input from government. I think this is a pressure on those businesses, Luke, that are dependent on labor that they're simply paying minimum wage. I remember there continues to be pressure. I know here in California, aren't we raising it to 15 over the next 3 years?
We are.
Yeah. So that put pressure on companies like McDonald's, and I think that will only continue. Now, in 2019, 1.6 million Americans earned no more than the federal minimum wage. That was about 1% of all workers, but 2% of those that were paid hourly. Less than half of those work full-time, so a lot of these are part-time workers. Almost half were aged 16 to 25, and more than 60% were basically waiters, right? Waiters and waitresses receiving additional tips. But still, this is pressure from across the board, across different states, and on the federal level. And the big question is, when will that actually come to fruition? I think a $15 minimum wage federally is probably inevitable. It's just, I think, is going to take the proper pressure from, you think, constituents, Luke? What do you think is going to change this and then ultimately put pressure on the businesses?
Yeah, I think it's difficult to say, because if you think about it, as of 2021, only 55.8% of all wages were hourly paid employees, and only 1.4% of workers in the United States earned the minimum wage. So typically, when you expect constituent pressure to make laws change, there aren't many people in the United States that are earning the minimum wage. So it's kind of difficult to say what's going to eventually push that upward on a federal level.
That is an interesting point, because yes, while it's popular, a minimum wage is popular, even on the right. I think, what was it, Florida? They voted for a minimum wage increase the last election, or in 2020, but Trump won the state, mm-hmm. right? So it's becoming more of a bipartisan issue, but it doesn't impact very many people. I think it's just more of principle that if you work 40 hours, that you should be paid some sort of a living wage. And that's ultimately going to, like I said, put pressure on those companies that are not doing so at the current time. So it will be very interesting to see how the dynamics play out going forward. All right. Let's talk a bit about this downgrade by Moody's. Well, I guess it wasn't a downgrade. It was putting the U.S. credit rating on watch. And this is, in some ways, long overdue. The S&P dropped the U.S. from AAA to AA+ in 2011. Fitch did it earlier this year. And so this is basically saying that they are on watch to downgrade us from AAA across all three major rating agencies. Now, what was different to me, Luke, about this announcement was before there was a lot of, or at least on the Fitch's announcement, it was more about, hey, Congress is dysfunctional, which we know it is. They are playing with defaulting on the debt, with not raising the debt ceiling, et cetera. But this one doesn't really talk much about that. It talks a lot more about the rising cost of interest. And it expects interest payments relative to the revenue to rise from around 9.7% last year to 26% by 2033. Basically, less than a decade away. And Moody's sees interest payments relative to GDP will rise to around 4.5% in 2033 from 1.9% today. So about a quarter of our revenue, or tax revenue, is going to be paid out just in interest in the next decade. Now, Luke, this kind of spooked the markets after hours, but as we talked about earlier, there wasn't a big market move. When will rubber hit the road here?
You know, I don't know if it will. I think that relative to the other ratings agencies, I tend to agree with what Moody's did more than with what Standard & Poor's and Fitch did, in that Moody's had a statement where they affirmed the U.S.'s rating, saying that formidable credit strengths continue to preserve the sovereign's rating, in particular exceptional economic strength, high institutional governance strength, and the unique and central roles of the U.S. dollar and treasury bond market in the global financial system. So to me, that means there is a problem with fiscal deficits. We all know this. There's no end in sight to that problem because, like you mentioned, Congress is dysfunctional. But at the end of the day, the U.S. dollar and the treasury bond play such a central role that it doesn't make any sense to downgrade the U.S.'s credit rating. And I agree with that.
Yes, you're right. There are definitely some strengths that will, I think, allow us to muddle through for an extended period of time, probably longer than most people realize. And you could even say today, right? The debt situation has been kind of snowballing for a while now. But as you said, the diversity of the economy, as well as the central role of the dollar globally, has kind of helped stave off those concerns. But in some ways, wouldn't you argue it's that role is kind of enabling government on both sides of the aisle to just ignore this and not think about any change to that status quo? We talked even on the webinar last week about how, you know, you can't really, you can mess around with the discretionary spending, but if you take this year, pretty much entitlements and interest payments are going to cover all of tax revenue. So if you're serious about cutting debt or getting the fiscal situation more in line with sustainability, then you have to touch entitlements. So, and but entitlements are, you know, they're kind of the third rail, right? So what will get government to act a little more responsibly?
I wish I had an answer to that. But I think that at the end of the day, these credit ratings are supposed to say how safe is an investment in the sovereign debt of a country. And so regardless of fiscal deficits, because the U.S.'s position is what it is in the global economy, I don't see an imminent risk, and apparently neither did Moody's, to the U.S.'s credit rating and therefore its ability to pay back its debts.
Yeah, I don't think this is really an ability to pay. It is more of how can, what is the path forward, I think, really? And you know, I guess the credit ratings are all about the ability to repay those debts and not default. And I don't think the U.S. government is ever going to default. No country that's ever been in control of their debt has defaulted nominally, meaning they don't pay down their debts. They just simply find ways to try to inflate away that debt, which is probably ultimately the path here. And so, you know, it still makes sense for us to have a high credit rating, but I think the release valve for all this is going to be in the currency markets. And I think that's ultimately how you eventually see problems, is probably in the currency markets.
Yeah, right. I think it's more of a warning to non-US countries that, mm-hmm. if anything, who's going to pay the price for the fiscal deficits? And that's external parties, not the US, trying to lend.
Yeah. Well, then that's also why you continue to see a decline in foreign direct investment in U.S. treasuries for, you know, in general. Obviously, there's still countries that buy a lot of ours, which are like Japan, but obviously China and other major countries are doing less of that. So they see the writing on the wall, both fiscally and geopolitically. And so that'll be interesting to watch as we go along over the next decade. All right. As regular listeners know, the InvestTalk Voice Bank never closes. You can call with your question anytime, day and night, at 888-99-CHARTS. Let's play another question now.
Hey, Steve and Justin. Bill from Philadelphia here. Justin, I guess this one's more for you. Toast, ticker symbol TOST. I was interested in picking it up for some time now, and I know that you liked it as well. They just had their earnings, and I mean, the numbers seem pretty good, but the stock drops close to 20%. Wanted to kind of get your thoughts now on if this is a great buying opportunity or if this is something that you should hold off and see where it lands after a few days or something like that, and then possibly pick up some. Or if you just think it's not good to stock anymore. Looking forward to hearing your thoughts on this, and thanks for what you guys do. Bye-bye.
All right, looking at toast. Now, let me correct you, and I think you always have to listen to exactly what I'm saying. I've never said I liked toast the stock. I said I like toast the product. It's a huge difference here, okay? And I think this still is a company with great potential. But if you go back and listen to any of the previous shows where I talked about toast, I always said, product is great, but the management of this company, I think, is off. And mainly because they're growing, but they're not doing it in a profitable way. And all they're doing is burning capital and issuing more shares. Look at the shares outstanding. They're going from up and to the right. And that I've said that many times. That's a problem. Until they can stop issuing shares and until they can start actually producing positive cash flows consistently and growing those cash flows, then it's a tough stock to really invest in. And that hasn't changed. Anything you're seeing on your side, Luke?
No debt, but still not making any money, so I would pass.
Well, they don't have any debt because they just issue more shares.
Exactly.
Hey, earth to the management. Stop issuing more shares. End it now. And get your company on the right path. And still it's not. The product is good, but the company is not. All right. Let's go to a break. Give me a call now at 888-99-CHART.
One of the most rewarding things I do each weekday is host the Invest Talk podcast. I truly enjoy helping investors, and I know that every question counts and every answer I provide will be unbiased. You, the caller, get to chart the course for each Invest Talk podcast. Call with your questions anytime, day or night, 888-99-CHART.
Hey, I was trying to reach Justin, Lou, or Steve. Trying to call you guys about ticker symbol LECO. This is Andrew from Atlanta. And just wanted to know your analysis on this. If you could look at the company's name is Lincoln Electric Holdings Incorporated. And just looking on my new Charles Schwab platform, it just got converted from TD and was curious your analysis, if you could let me know. We really like the show. Thank you.
All right, looking at Lincoln Electric, a manufacturer of welding, cutting, and brazing products around the world. And it has the top market share within the space. Very good company. Long-term profitability is very consistent. In fact, it's near record highs, right, Luke? You would put this in probably the top quartile of prof metrics, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And it's not just there now. It's been consistently growing. I mean, over the past 5 years, its EBITDA growth is significantly higher than its competitors. It has minimal debt, and the debt it has, it pushed out beyond 2033 for the most part. I'm not really seeing anything I don't like.
Yeah, this is a very good business, good cash flows. Enterprise value to EBITDA is right around 15 times. I would say that's or on the long-term average. So I would say it's not cheap or expensive. I would say it's fairly valued. The technicals are fine. It's a very good business. But, I'm okay paying a fair price for a very good business. So I'm going to give Lincoln Electric a thumbs up. All right. Let's lastly touch on AI and the fact that one thing AI is allowing investors to do is to analyze the conference calls and not just look at the words that the management teams are saying, but how they are saying them as well to glean whether or not they are being forthright completely about the trajectory of their business. Now, for many years, funds have used algorithms to look at just the call transcripts. So the words that people are saying on these calls, and they're using natural language processing to glean signals about the true trend of the business. So Luke, is this that next evolution that is going to allow investors to really hone in on the true trend of the business as opposed to the kind of fluffy language the C-suite will use many times?
I mean, certainly it's the next iteration. I think the question that has to be asked is how effective is it going to be? I think that some of the concerns that I have hearing about it is how do you, from person to person, use a model to analyze the way they talk, given that they could switch up the person who's presenting? If a new CEO steps in and all of a sudden he's doing the earnings calls, how good is the model that you had for the previous one? Are companies now just going to spend more money with PR firms that are teaching them to hide their true emotions? So certainly it's the next iteration of using that natural language processing to try and glean an advantage in the market in terms of trading. But how effective is it going to be in the long term is an entirely different question.
Yeah, that's my biggest worry, is that people will maybe extrapolate the few times where AI gets it right. And how truly accurate is it? Especially because maybe these people are speaking, their native language is different than English, right? So they may have an accent, for example. And so the insights certainly are going to improve over time, and there's certainly limitations. But I think it's just another tool. And it'll be interesting to see how readily available these tools will get over time. There is a company called Speechcraft Analytics that does this already, but it certainly will likely be a tool that we rolled out on other platforms over time as well. All right, I'm Justin Klein. This concludes another Invest Talk program. Steve Peasley and I thank you for listening, and we encourage you to tell your friends and family about our free podcast downloads, which you can find anytime at iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play. Independent thinking, shared success. This is Invest Talk. Good night.
InvestTalk is a trademark of KPP Financial. Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for the listener to understand that not all comments made will apply to them. Specifically, nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell security. Because such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor firm, which retains all rights. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. Steve Peasley is president, and Justin Klein is chief executive officer of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial. Thank you for listening, and your comments and questions are welcome on our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART.